My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. Before we dive into this week's episode, I just wanted to pay tribute to Stanton Friedman, who has sadly passed away this week. Friedman had been a titan for the investigation and understanding of the UFO subject for over 50 years. Sharp-witted, determined, and yet humble, his voice was instantly recognisable, and it will always be a regret of mine that I never got the opportunity to speak to him. If anything, his loss will leave a massive hole in the field of ufology, but his influence cannot be underestimated. He has inspired and educated thousands of us around the world and shown a resilience to keep fighting for the truth, no matter what the authorities may say. His legacy will live on as we all try to move forward. Rest in peace, Stanton. With that, I was honoured to speak to someone who I view as both brave and fiercely determined, Dr. Lynn Keetye. Anyone who has studied the Phoenix Lights will immediately recognise her name and her continuing fight for the truth. I am utterly convinced that something strange is still going on in that area, and continue to believe that there is still more to come. But just before we dive into that, don't forget to support us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and YouTube, and you can support us on Patreon for just $1 a month. Rate and review us on your podcast provider and share wherever you can. Now, join myself and Dr. Lynn Keetye as we delve into the incredible and continuing Phoenix Lights incidents. My guest on this episode is Dr. Lynn Keetye from America. For anyone with an interest in ufology, Dr. Lynn is synonymous with the incredible story of the Phoenix Lights, which occurred on the 13th of March 1997. If we are to be honest, the Phoenix Light is probably the most witnessed mass sighting in history. Thousands of witness sightings, countless photos and video footage has cemented this case at the forefront of anyone's mind who has looked into it or studied it in any detail at all. As time has gone on, the Phoenix Light has continued to grow and evidence is still being uncovered. I am delighted to have Dr. Lynn Keetye with me tonight. Thank you for joining me today.
Delighted to be here, Paul. Thank you so much for having me and actually sharing the inside Phoenix Light story, because there is so much mis and disinformation out there that has really gotten mixed with some truths. But I've been following the story actually before the mass sighting, so I can certainly lend my expertise and my experience to the table here. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. I mean, when I first saw the footage back in 97 on a couple of programs that were shown over here, notably Sightings was probably the first time I saw the footage, Dr. Lynn. I mean, when you look back 22 years, obviously from the main incident, did you think that it would continue to keep developing and changing as much as it had over the years?
That's a really good question. Actually, having seen the same phenomena up close and personal 2 years prior to the mass sighting in 95, right outside our bedroom window, I should clarify that both my husband and I are physicians. We're healthy skeptics. One must be when you're a doctor for anything that walks through the door. But we are also have to see it to believe it type people. And we live very high on a mountain in Paradise Valley, Arizona, which Actually, there are mountain ranges that surround the valley. They call it the Valley of the Sun, which is Phoenix, and mountains on the other side that we look at from our vantage point. So we and the airport is right in front of South Mountain. In fact, if anybody is near a computer and can go on the Phoenix Lights Network website, www.thephoenixlights.net, which is packed with really intriguing information to explore and consider, and go to the photo page. You will see the topography of our view from our mountainside home. And it's really a panoramic view of the city skyline, and we see the airport as well. So we know what planes and helicopters and streetlights and car lights and house lights and so forth look like. Well, on February 6, 1995, actually the eve of my birthday, I do not believe in coincidence anymore, but that's one little coincidence. I was taking a leisurely bath in a room that's adjacent to the bedroom, where one wall of our bedroom is a window. And my husband was standing at the window speaking to my mother-in-law from back east. We're both from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. As she called to wish me a happy birthday, and suddenly, which was very odd for him because he is really a man's man. He's been on several hospital and medical boards, not one to get excited about things. And here he shouts out, "Get over here quick! What the hell is this?" And I grab my towel and run, wringing wet, to the window, dripping wet. And here, a little below us. And we're in a private, gated, nestled in the mountains community, were three amber orbs in a pyramid formation, one on top and two closely aligned underneath. And about 50, 75 feet off the very treacherous desert landscape. And, your first thought is to grab a camera when you see something that unusual. But my video camera was downstairs. I didn't want to miss anything. And you'll hear from many people who have had paranormal experiences that you are just so mesmerized by what you're seeing because it's so extraordinary, you don't want to move, which I did not. But I tried to take everything in mentally, the size, the shape, the color. And I always go back to this sighting because I saw these up close and personal, and they were orbs. And I call them an orb because light did not extend outside the edge. It was self-contained. They were about 3 to 6 feet each, depending on how close they were. And they were actually oval shaped, like an egg on its side, totally equidistant from each other, very closely aligned. And the color within each orb was a uniform amber color throughout. It didn't glare at all. And I noticed immediately all the other lights out there glared. These did not. They were very unusual and mesmerizing. And I thought, if I don't get a picture of this, nobody's going to believe it. And I have to tell you that prior to this, both my husband and I had no interest or knowledge in this phenomenon at all. So having this right outside our bedroom window was really extraordinary. And I go running to grab my 35 millimeter camera that I keep handy for our beautiful sunsets here in Arizona. And my husband calls me back. He said, "Get over here quick. One of them is disappearing." And we both watched as the top orb, without budging from the other two, and again, I always go back to this because it was so strange, it started to dim, like on a dimmer switch, kind of mechanically shrinking very, very slowly, as if there was an intelligence behind it, until it was the size of a pea and then disappeared. But it felt like it was still there. Where did it go? And I jump out on the balcony, get a quick picture of the two lower orbs, which I have posted on the Phoenix Lights Network photo page, so anybody can go there and take a peek. And immediately noticed an eerie silence, as if time had stopped. It was just bizarre. And as intently as I was looking at these two lower orbs, and I didn't share this with a soul until 2 years later after the mass sighting, it felt like something was watching me. And going through my mind, I was thinking, who are you? What are you? Do you know that I'm here? I'd love to meet you. That's exactly what I was thinking. The next thing I remember, the left bottom orb started to shrink, just like the top one did, in place. And I quickly got a shot of that. Now, that picture is also, that's the last picture I took, which is also on that, on the photo page on the Phoenix Lights Network website. But what's interesting, that was the only one that turned out at the time. But for me, it was confirmatory that we did see something unusual. It was close. I captured a picture. It's 35 millimeter. It's in the negative. But I didn't even know who to show it to. I knew no one who was interested in the topic, and actually wondered for 2 years, looking out periodically through our bedroom window, what this advanced technology was doing right outside our bedroom window, why my husband and I saw it together so we could confirm it, etc. Well, 2 years passed, didn't see anything even remotely like these orbs until 2 months before the mass sighting. And this is really significant because they were around before March 13th. I noticed three giant, huge orbs, balls, in an equidistant line formation far west. And I mentioned it to my husband. He kind of blew it off. And that's also an interesting aspect. Everybody comes from a different background, different belief system, different worldview. Some people can't deal with this topic. Yeah. And some people don't want to. My husband didn't want to. But that's okay. That's okay. And if you have to feed into a logical explanation, that's okay. Everyone in their own time.
Yeah.
But for me, as a scientist, I was really taking note of everything. And the orbs disappeared, started to shrink one by one, from right to left, they were gone. The next night, my husband was at a medical board meeting, and I happened to notice, because I was in the bedroom, that the three orbs in an equidistant line were now in front of South Mountain through the sliding glass doors. And I thought, okay, enough. I've got to get this on video. So I grabbed my camera, went outside, and it was charged. Got about 18 seconds worth, the battery goes dead, which was very disappointing. I go inside and I plug it up. I go plug it in electricity. I go outside, they're gone. About a half hour later, about 8:30, my husband comes up the drive. And again, we're pretty high on the mountain. And I go outside and I said, honey, remember I told you about the three lights in an equidistant line formation last night, far west? Well, about a half hour ago, they were right in front of South Mountain. And I knew they were in front of South Mountain because there's red blinking lights on the mountain to alert pilots that are coming into Sky Harbor, which is just in front of South Mountain. And I said, as I'm pointing, I say they were right in front of South Mountain. As I'm pointing, they reappeared in the same spot. And whoa, I've got to get a picture of this. And luckily, again, I don't believe in coincidence anymore. Video does not do the lights justice. They are much smaller, they're white, and they flicker in the video. Even though the formations, if you really look at them, are really compelling. Nonetheless, 35 millimeter, it's in the negative. Okay, it can't be denied. So anyway, I run upstairs. I grab my 35 millimeter while my video camera was being charged. I get out on the balcony. As I'm ready to shoot the three, suddenly six lights pop on above the three, massive span, over a mile wide. It was unnerving. Not having an explanation for the close sighting 2 years before, I started to shake. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, is this a mothership or a fleet? I mean, it was just so extraordinary to see six equidistant lights pop up over the three. And thank goodness, I mean, if you look at that first picture, you'll see it's wavy because I was shaking. But luckily, I stuck to it and I kept taking pictures, the second picture of which is really significant because if you take a look, and I always say the data speaks for itself, there are five lights. The one in the center with two on each side is brighter than the ones on each side. And it looks like there's two underneath, two of these orbs. Well, interestingly, many, many people described, and we're talking over 10,000 people saw the mass sighting 2 months later, And many described the phenomena as the formation of five lights with two trailing lights. Now, there's a picture 2 months before, a 35 millimeter. As I continued photographing this series, it looks like what I was capturing head on turned into a V formation. And the last picture, if you look at it, is pretty significant in and of itself, because the next day, the next morning, I did not sleep well that night, by the way, just thinking, okay, there must be a logical explanation. And I called around, found air traffic controllers at Sky Harbor International Airport, who admitted to me, they were very forthcoming initially, that indeed they had seen the three at 8 o'clock, and they were excited that I had seen the six pop up at 8:30, and described them as six points of light totally equidistant from each other, massive span over a mile wide, over Class B restricted airspace, which is a 30-mile radius around the center of the airport. Anybody that comes into that airspace, especially 1,000 feet altitude that these were, must call into the tower, and no one did. Yeah. So they looked on radar, did not show up on radar. They took up their high-powered binoculars to look, and again, in their own words, there were six points of light that seemed to be attached to something. You will hear this again by many people March 13th, but they couldn't quite see what these lights were attached to. Again, massive span, over a mile wide, that actually one of them was a meteorologist and stated that the whole thing turned as a unit against the wind, which is also significant, elevated slowly and moved in synchrony behind South Mountain. So I said, so what was it? And this was a whole group that saw this. And one of the air traffic controllers said, beats me. I said, you're an air traffic controller. You're supposed to know what's in our airspace. You don't know what these were. And he said that they ruled out every conventional possibility of conventional aircraft, balloons, blimps, Chinese lanterns, flares, even skydivers with lights. We kept in contact. I continued photographing these phenomena, both on video and 35 millimeter, up until and including March 13th, 1997. Now, for me, it was just another night. But for thousands of people out there who were looking up at the sky purposely for a glimpse of the Hale-Bopp comet, they also caught a glimpse of a mile, and we just learned a couple years ago from thousands of reports to the UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, Peter Davenport stated at several conferences now that one of these objects was 8 miles wide. So we're talking so massive that it's just mind-boggling, okay? And not only was it orbs that seemed to be attached to something or had a force field holding them in rock solid formation, as many people would describe, but there were also actual craft. Now, here's another significant data for you. After a 12-year study, because again, there is so much mis- and disinformation there, I can understand how the media picked up on the fact that from 8 to 10 that evening, when most people were outside looking up at the sky at the Hale-Bopp comet, is also when most people that saw these phenomena right over their heads at rooftop level called the news stations, Luke Air Force Base, the police station to report what they were seeing. However, in reality, the mass sightings started on March 13th at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. There were daylight sightings in Arizona, 5 o'clock hour by Native Americans who reported them in New Mexico, the 7 o'clock hour in California. And in fact, there were two separate commercial airlines that saw one of these mile wide craft cover Las Vegas during the 11 o'clock hour. And that's a story in itself that I describe in detail in the book when they tried to report it. And these sightings continued, even though the reports, you know, the bulk was between 8 and 10, the sightings continued till 5:30 the next morning, the most credible report that we have is at 5:30, the crew from Boeing was coming into the airport, and one of them actually shared with me that the whole crew saw one of these craft cover their tarmac. So we're talking over a dozen hours, and not only one or two events, as you would hear in the media, there were many events that were over a dozen hours of these orbs. And also after a 12-year study, again, if you're on the Phoenix Lights Network website, I welcome you to take a peek at the GAP page, G-A-P, Geospatial Animation Project, which was a 12-year study of thousands of reports to the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, to Arizona MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, to Village Labs, which was a huge computer lab where one of the investigators was actually, by coincidence, an investigator of UFOs and pictures from all over the world. That's how I first found out it was happening all over the world. Also over 1,000 reports from Phoenix Councilwoman Vice Mayor Frances Barwood, who, by the way, was the only elected official who innocently, she didn't see it, but she had so many calls from her constituents. She was just doing her job in a May meeting. This is months later, and we'll get to that. Innocently asked for an investigation, and she was plastered by the media. There was so much ridicule and snickering and discrediting going on. I was so glad I kept anonymous for 7 years. By the way, we'll get back to that. 7 years I kept anonymous, but keeping an intricate journal once I knew thousands of people saw what I had been seeing. But anyway, from a 12-year study of all these thousands of reports, it was concluded that there were 10 different craft. Now, they're illustrated, and also there's animations on the GAP page, Geospatial Animation Project, on the Phoenix Lights Network website. And it's so fascinating because I didn't see this until it was finished. And number one, the different craft, I mean, they really look different. Now, whether it was one craft that could morph into looking different, the perspective from where the person was standing, or a parade, which is ultimately what the investigators concluded, because there were so many things going on at the same time in different locations in Arizona, in Nevada, in California, in New Mexico. So we're talking an unbelievable event that took place. Now, also, which is really interesting, when you look at the craft themselves, I mean, the technology alone that people were seeing, and we have to remember, everyone said that whatever they saw, whether it was a mile to 8 mile wide, was silent, totally silent. Some people saw it take off these craft that had gunmetal at the bottom, and some people saw windows and beings at the windows and got telepathic messages. When it took off at blink speed, it didn't disperse the air at all. Other people, and if you look at that page, you'll see one of the craft actually split in two and then shot up. One of the craft, which really blew me away, because once I saw my investigation, I found out that a month before our mass sighting, there was another mass sighting, but it was at St. Petersburg, Russia. And there were a couple people, civilians, who captured video, one of which is identical to one of the craft that's like a V craft with every light is actually three lights. And another one that has a light in the center. I mean, a triangle. I mean, it's just really amazing that they were seeing the same thing there of multiple different craft a month before our mass sighting. Also, there were air traffic controllers there that reported some of these craft over their tarmac in St. Petersburg, Russia. Okay. So here we have an incredible, incredible sighting. And also some people saw these orbs detach from the main object, go out into the environment, and then redock with it later. So, you know, we're really talking about incredible technology that, Paul, we haven't seen in 22 years. I mean, it's over 22 years. Have you seen anything that even comes close to this type of technology? And at 3 a.m. the next morning, and in our documentary, and also in the book, I describe it, but in the documentary, we have part of that actual recording of an alleged crewman from Luke Air Force Base who called the UFO Reporting Center, very detailed, very professional, that there was one of these craft, mile-wide craft, hovering right over central Phoenix at 8:30 that evening. And jets were sent out from Luke Air Force Base to intercept it and get gun camera film, which we heard they did get gun camera film. But as they got closer, the lights started to dim. And then as they got even closer to this object, it totally disappeared and blinked out. And the crewman said that he was one of the people that helped one of the pilots from Luke Air Force Base out of his aircraft because he was so shaken up by what happened. And also that Luke was on lockdown after that. So they were very well aware of what was happening. Now, as all this is happening, okay, and I had no idea that thousands of people were seeing what I was seeing. I actually saw three orbs pop up just like I did a month before, about 8:30 in that span, but I didn't even get up because to film them, because coincidentally, a couple weeks before, because it was getting very frustrating not knowing what we were dealing with, I started to show my video to my friends and ask them if they know anyone that I can consult with about what is going on. And this is how close I was, Paul. A friend of a friend had a neighbor who had a friend who knew the past president of MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, which I had never heard of before.
Yeah.
And I called him up. I said, look, I have a picture from 95, because that was the only one that turned out at the time, that I know is authentic, but I'd love someone of credence to take a look at it and tell me what it is. And I have been photographing these big orbs and formations at a distance. He had not heard about it, but there were other people besides myself that were also seeing them and photographing them. In fact, Steve Blonder called MUFON up to his balcony the night of March 13th because he was also photographing them for days before. And while they're up there, suddenly a V formation, like an arrowhead of five lights pops up that is just spectacular. I mean, those lights are attached to something or have a force field in between. They're just rock solid in that arrowhead formation. Now, his and my video were shot before 10 o'clock. After 10 o'clock, there were two boomerangs, and very impressive. But nonetheless, they've been the ones that have been under fire for the only explanation that they ever came up with, which I will share to your audience in a minute. Because, oddly enough, after thousands and thousands of people were outside purposely looking up at the sky for a glimpse of the Hale-Bopp Comet and caught a glimpse of these incredibly advanced technologies right above their heads, some people said they could have thrown a rock at it, it was so close, there was nothing said by the military or government for months. Absolutely not a word. In fact, when Frances Barwood, the Phoenix councilwoman and vice mayor, asked in May, months later, for an investigation, the other government officials would say, what, something happened on March 13th? They really blew it off until, and this is where it really gets interesting, suddenly there was a front page article on June 18th, 97. For whatever reason, it opened up our sighting to people outside of Arizona for the very first time. Because as I said, the media really put a lid on this. I mean, there were a few TV reports, but other than that, the paper didn't do much. They had an article like a week later in the middle of the paper. I mean, it was very odd.
Yeah.
But this front page, really, I mean, we didn't have social media then. And overnight, it went viral. By the next morning, and we had inquiries from people from all over the world, including UK. Once they started talking to the witnesses, their reports were so detailed and so heartfelt that they too were asking, why isn't there an investigation? Why isn't there an explanation? Suddenly, we get an announcement late morning, the next morning, the 19th of June, that then Governor Fife Symington, Arizona governor, was calling a press conference that afternoon, unscheduled, to reveal the quote unquote culprit of the lights over Phoenix.
Yeah.
And everybody took it quite seriously until he comes marching out, one of his aides, in a giant alien head costume and made a joke of it, made a mockery of it, which was very disconcerting, not only for the witnesses, but certainly for parents that were with children that saw craft, actual craft, that were bigger than 2 and 3 miles moles wide, and he's making a mockery of it. But that kind of put a lid on it.
I mean, I've when I saw the documentary, because obviously there is, I mean, I've actually seen footage of the press conference, Dr. Lin. And so I've obviously, because I've watched the documentary that was made in 2005, a fantastic film. It completely reconfirmed my feelings about the whole case. I remember that, and I can only empathize with the people that had seen something, because like you refer to, you've got parents there with their children who are absolutely convinced that what they've seen is not, you know, the usual explanations.
Not a joke.
Yeah, it's not a joke. It wasn't flares. I mean, I've seen all the excuses that were given. I mean, the Cessna excuse is just ridiculous. But
and even stealth. I mean, stealth is radar evasive. It's not sound evasive. And it's interesting that you bring up that you saw the press conference, and I don't know how much of it you saw, because coming up, I'm speaking at the Contact in the Desert event, which is last weekend in May in Indian Wells, California. And a couple years ago, I also spoke there, and I did a workshop about how it affected, which I'm doing this year as well, even more, how it affected the witnesses, which we can get to if we have time, very, very deeply, but besides the hardware. But a lady raised her hand in the audience, and she said, "I was there at that press conference." I said, "Really?" I said, "Please tell." And she said, which most of the video that I've seen of that press conference, it shows the governor bringing out the aide with a giant alien head costume and, you know, trying to make a joke out of it. And people initially laughed. Then he told them to turn off their cameras because there was media there. And after they did, they were angry. Now, I don't know if you saw anything that resembled that, but she said that the audience was really, really disturbed that he had done this and pulled this mockery, because they really took it seriously. And she said that they were really angry. I have not seen video of that. I would love to. But people think that because they hear the audience laughing, that everybody, which people chuckle when they hear or saw the aide with the alien head costume anyway. But what she said was that the audience was really angry and started to really pillage him with assault, verbal assault, for doing that. Anyway, once he did that, and it's also, again, interesting how the story unfolded here, which we'll be talking about at the Contact in the Desert, with how it unfolded through the media, because a month later, now, during that month, I really tried to do my homework. I called every military base, because to me it was not a joke. And I wanted a logical explanation, I'll be honest. I mean, I was looking, I had been looking for 22 years for a logical explanation. Every person I talked to, and there's quite a few military bases here, and I tried to get as high up as I could, wanted to see my data, wanted to see my photographs, which I would not even go there. I wanted to stay anonymous. But they were just as curious. And suddenly, on July the 24th, I get a phone call from one of the heads of the PR for the Air National Guard. And she says, "Oh, Dr. Lin, I think we know what those lights were back in March." And I said, "You do?" And I was thrilled that they knew. She said, "Do you believe in all these months, nobody ever looked at the log for visiting Air National Guard, and the Maryland Air National Guard was in town sending off military illumination flares in Operation Snowbird," which I later found out means military, in military terms, means diversionary tactical maneuvers. Now, keep in mind, I had mentioned they knew what was going on at 8:30. Okay. So if they sent off flares to divert attention away from the true unknowns, okay, that's reasonable. Although I have not met one person or heard one report that even comes close to what flares do. So I said to her, I said, well, wait a minute. When did the Maryland National Guard come in town? She said, March 1st to the 15th. I said, were they in town in January? She said, oh, no. I said, are you sure? She said, absolutely not. I said, well, I have 35 millimeter evidence, photographic evidence of the same exact phenomena in the same exact location. 2 months before the mass sighting, confirmed both mornings after January and the mass sighting by air traffic controllers as hovering about 1,000 feet altitude over Class B restricted airspace. And she says, you never told me that, because I never gave you details of what I saw. And I said, and besides, you're trying to say that flares, and by then I'd educated myself to what any logical explanation, including flares, look like, that drift and drop with the wind, they're on parachutes, and they drift haphazardly, huge smoke trails. They're illuminated by the flare itself, and they are meant, I mean, military illumination flares are used to illuminate the area around it. And again, not one person described that. You saw the true unknowns. And I said to her, traverse the entire state in a rock-solid, mile-wide, equidistantly spaced V formation for hours? And she says, I have a call coming in. I'll get back to you. Well, I'm still waiting.
I mean,
22 years later, I'm still waiting.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that's one of the things, you know, like you've referred to about the disinformation or the suppression of it. I think if you ask your average person if they know anything about the Phoenix Light, they think it's that 2 hour window between 8 and 10,
right,
just over Phoenix, and that's it. And like you've referred to earlier, there were sightings prior to that date. There were sightings in different states. There were sightings from different vantage points, from different angles. It would be physically impossible for that to be flares under any circumstances, regardless of that. And I just find it, once again, incredulous that it takes the military 4 months to say, oh, by the way, it was this. Because surely if you've got a situation like that, Dr. Lynn, the easiest way to put it to bed is to say something in the immediate aftermath, not wait till there's a massive furore about the whole situation and for people to be ridiculed by Fife Symington, who strangely, and I mean to ask you about this, ended up changing his opinion.
Wait a minute,
about the whole
we'll
thing.
Get to that. Because it's interesting how this unfolds, because
absolutely.
I bet you don't know this either. And your audience probably doesn't know this. To your point, whoever came up with the flare theory was actually brilliant, because they could blow off people's stories, and say they didn't know what they were looking at, that it was conventional, that it was a mirage, whatever, it was a hologram, but they could not blow off the handful of videos that night. They had to come up with something for those videos. And as I described earlier, in video, the lights are much smaller, they're white, they flicker, but if you really look at those videos, the formations are so compelling. But most people will look for a logical explanation, which is okay, I was too, and feed into the flare theory, and that's okay, except that they weren't flares, okay. But be that as it may, 3 years later, and this is another significant, I'm just sharing the highlights here. There's much more, because I ended up with a 750-page journal, daily journal, 7 years later. But anyway, 3 years later, former Vice Mayor, Phoenix Vice Mayor Francis Barwood, was running for Secretary of State on a platform to get answers for the lights over Phoenix. And she was asking, just as a public safety issue, she was asking for a reenactment. Now, right before the third anniversary, we get a public announcement from the radio and TV reporters that three Air National Guards, now this was publicly disseminated, that three Air National Guards were coming into town, I believe it was New York, Michigan, and California, to show everyone the Phoenix lights. Now, whether they thought they would confuse the issue or diffuse the issue or whatever, it was, talk about a joke. They failed miserably. And if you go on, again, just look at the data. If you go on the Phoenix Lights Network news page and scroll down to about...
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
The middle there, you'll see a block that says AZ Family, which was CNN at the time. And they took footage of their flare drop. Not only was it upside down, but it fell apart immediately. It had huge smoke trails, as flares do, and could not keep the formation, and just confirmed. I mean, here they had their shot, right? They confirmed that what thousands of people saw definitely were not flares. They have never been recreated. Plus, which is also interesting, the craft and people, I mean, we had pilots and military that were right underneath us. We have a pilot, as you saw in the documentary, who looked into one of these, what he would call well or canister, these lights that, I mean, they were right underneath these things. The craft have never been addressed at all, ever. Okay, so here we have the flare drop. They kind of put a nail in the coffin. Then another thing that really put a nail in the coffin was right after the 10th anniversary, for whatever reason, our former governor, Arizona Governor Symington, who mocked the sighting in 97, came forward bravely to say that he actually witnessed one of these mile-wide craft. And in his opinion, and he's a was an awarded military pilot, it definitely was not flares, and he described it as otherworldly, which is also how other countries, there's at least 20 other countries that are much more open to these phenomena as being otherworldly, describe it. So that really was a giant step, I think, for, and that the more credible people that come forward, the better, for really getting the truth out there. Also, what's interesting is when I called the air traffic controllers the next morning after the mass sighting, and they told me that they ruled out every conventional aircraft, it was the same exact phenomena in the same exact location as 2 months before, and there were pilots that called into the tower. One had the object was right above them, a commercial pilot, and a private pilot, it was right in front of them, right? Well, I describe in the book, in the first edition, it's now in its third edition, because I found that very compelling that a pilot had called in, a commercial pilot, to say the least, that the lights were right above him, or the object was right above him. As he would say it, the object was right above him. And never knowing who these pilots were, one of the private pilot, just came forward last year. And lo and behold, that private pilot and his report is right on the homepage of the Phoenix Lights Network website and also on the news page. Turned out to be none other than actor or celebrity Kurt Russell.
I actually saw him, Dr. Lynn, when...
It was in UK.
They were on, it was just after the second Guardians of the Galaxy film had come out. And he was doing the press, and he was on a show on BBC One early evening, and they did something about the Phoenix Lights, and he basically said, "That's me. I'm the man. I'm the pilot that reported it." Because I was going to mention Kurt Russell, because I was watching that program because I'm a big fan of Kurt Russell, and also I'm a big Marvel geek. So for me, it was a win-win. And then to see that they were doing a segment about the Phoenix Lights, which I knew about anyway, I was like, "Well, this is fantastic." So to see him then admit on live television in the UK that it was him, I just found incredible, I just found it remarkable that he felt comfortable enough to come forward and support the thousands of witnesses
exactly.
with his own experience. I mean, have you had the opportunity to speak to him in person?
No, and I have tried. I'm getting closer. I know he would really appreciate it if he hasn't read the book already, yeah. That I mentioned a pile of, you know, saw it. But it's so interesting that while I was filming, I mean, the first thing that happened to me during the mass sighting is that just like 2 months before, the 6 lights popped up. And then by the time I got my camera out there, it turned to 3 lights and I got the 3 endpoints of a giant V or triangle or whatever it was, which is exactly what he was saying. His son, I mean, it's very interesting. His son, and they had a place, Goldie Hawn, he's been partnered with for many decades.
Yep.
And he had a place out in Carefree, Arizona, which isn't far from Phoenix. And I don't know if they still do, but he was on approach with his son who had a date. And his son, and that's the other interesting aspect, is that children, and we'll get to that in a minute, because there was not one in 22 years, not one report of harm, threat, or abduction associated with the Phoenix Lights phenomenon. I can't speak for other things, but I can for the Phoenix Lights, and we'll get to that in a second, how it affected people at a very deep level. Mm. But the other aspect was that children were usually the first to see it. Now, he wasn't a child, but he was a young person, and noted it to Kurt Russell, his dad, and who then called the air traffic control and reported it. They both totally never talked about it again. And this is also another significant aspect, how it affected people. We have a psychiatrist who just came forward last year for the first time publicly, but I do write about him in the book, who was coming up from Tucson to Phoenix for a swim meet. And one of these craft was actually above their car. He was in the passenger seat, and he looked at it very, very closely. And the arm, the wings expanded on both sides of this giant highway into the fields on both sides. Nobody said a word to each other for months. And just like Kurt Russell, they saw something months and months later on TV, and then suddenly a floodgate opened of remembrance, just like it did with Kurt Russell, because Russell talks about in this report, and I do have the UK report posted on the website, that he walked in a couple years later, and Goldie Hawn, who supposedly is very into the topic, was watching a UFO program, and they mentioned the Phoenix Lights, and that a pilot had called in to report the lights, and he thought, wait a minute, you know, it was like a Richard Dreyfuss moment, like in Close Encounters, where he thought, wait a minute, that sounds really familiar. He goes and he looks at his log and sees that it was March 13th, that it was him. So he has it documented in his log, which is really cool. So anyway, that is another aspect that's really important, is that the more credible people that come forward, the more credibility we can lend to this topic. And that was one of the reasons I came forward. Just so it's not about me, it's about the data. Yeah. But after thousands of people had seen what I had seen, Paul, I really did. I pushed my whole medical career aside for 7 years, meticulously searching for a logical explanation while I kept an intricate journal every single day of the media reports, of witness reports, of the history of these phenomena, which is a vast history. You don't have time to get into it today, but there is a vast history from the time human documentation began, even in primitive caves where they have long extinct animals etched out on the walls, but above them are UFOs, what we would call UFOs today, or Sumerian writings, India writings, even the Bible with Ezekiel's wheel, and then the 15th and 16th centuries with paintings and frescoes with people on the ground looking up at what we would call UFO, with even beings in the UFOs, and then World War II. We have Foo Fighters. They called them Foo Fighters, not the band, but these orbs, these orbs that are identical to the Phoenix Lights. In fact, Dr. Richard Haynes, who was the head, he was the founder of NARCAP, which is the aviation reports, thousands of reports by pilots. They were absolutely told that they could not talk about this. It's just being released now, as we know. I guess you heard in the UK that the New York Times had a front page article revealing that there was a $22 million study. And this was like December 2017. And now revealing also some of the video that the pilots have indicated are definitely, well, they call them unexplained aerial phenomena, a UAP. They can't be explained, and that they're, you know, they're actually studying it, which they have been for decades. They just haven't talked about it. But anyway, getting back to how journal, once I had 750 pages of just such credible data that was just so compelling of the history of these phenomena, just so much data that was just so revealing, including the fact that not only were children usually the first to notice this, and remember that, and we talk about this in the documentary, as you know, that we are so inundated with fear, and threat. How are we supposed to react when we see something unusual, particularly after the movie Independence Day?
Yeah.
Very popular 6 months before the mass sighting. So children, who were usually the first ones to notice these mile-wide V-formation and larger lights coming towards them, were jumping up and down, Independence Day. But as the formation or craft or whatever got closer, a calmness came over everyone. Adults and children alike, a connectedness to the phenomena that after it breezed by, glided by silently, they wanted to chase it or get in their car. You know, the parents would get in the car and follow it. It's amazing in real time. And long term, that's also really significant because not only, and people say, do you believe in UFOs? It's not a belief. For the people that saw the Phoenix Lights mass sighting, I have had over and over again them tell me they were in awe, they were in wonder, they felt blessed to have had the experience. To this day, it affected them at a very, very deep level. It's not a belief anymore, it's a knowing that we are not alone. Whoever did this not only wanted to let people know, one person at a time, that they are here, in a not very non-threatening, gentle way, but that we are not alone, and that we are also very, very important spiritual beings. Now, going back to my research, I found that there were a number of witnesses who had had near-death experiences. We don't talk about this in the documentary, but in the book, half the book is about this. Half the book is about what happened with the Phoenix Lights and really getting into the data and the hard data as well, and the history of these phenomena, because they're happening worldwide for centuries. And Native cultures are very hooked into that. I'll tell you that in a second. But a number of witnesses had near-death experiences as children that was reawakened by the Phoenix Lights mass sighting, which I found very poignant because I did too. And we don't have time to get into it, but I lay it all out there in the book. But what was really profound to me is, well, could there be a connection between all unexplained phenomena, whether it's near-death experience, out-of-body experience, unexplained aerial phenomena that have a mystical light that's associated with the experience? And lo and behold, when I started researching that aspect, I started finding university studies, the Omega Project by Dr. Kenneth Ring at the University of Connecticut. It's like a 4-inch book about the connection. Yeah. And I make it very simple in the book. Not only the experience is very simple, whatever the unexplained phenomena, but the after effect, the positive enlightenment, the connectedness to the universe, to the earth, to each other. I started calling all unexplained phenomena an up, UP, an up, because it is an up. And I always say, look up, you know, keep looking up, but that's a double entendre, because it's really important that people realize how these phenomena really touch people at such a deep soul level, which does not happen with planes or helicopters or holograms or flares.
Yeah, I mean, have you, when you've been speaking to people since, obviously, you know, and as more and more people come forward, I've often found it very intriguing when people have had experiences similar to this, Dr. Lynn, and in other incidents, and you've referred to it there about the spiritual awakening. But I've often heard witnesses, be it to a sighting of a craft or lights or a being that they can't explain, that for some people, they tend, after the aftermath for them, they tend to feel more concerned about the environment.
They
tend to drift. I've heard people who were quite politically motivated that have found themselves drifting across to be a more ecologically balanced person. Does that make sense?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because as I described in real time, the entire persona of people changed. Although there wasn't any fear, children were fearful because of Independence Day. They were so inundated with threat, and harm, harm, harm. How do you think they were going to react, right? But the after effect is so profound. People not only change their worldview forever, that we're not alone in the universe, and it's not a belief, it's a knowing, but people went into the environmental movement. People went into the peace movement. People changed their eating habits. They don't eat meat anymore. I mean, there was such a transformation, a positive transformation, some would say. That's why I call it an up. And I'm glad that you really addressed that, because that, to me, is one of the most interesting and important aspects of the Phoenix Lights mass sighting. It's not only the hard data, which is also very intriguing, and to this day we still don't know what they were. People ask me all the time, I don't know what they were, I just know that they were. And then it's time we get this topic out in the open and stop with the ridicule and the snickering and the jokes. It's time to accept it and to study it. Yeah. So that we can move forward and not only find out who's driving these things, because there could be a myriad of different conclusions of who's driving these things, but also move forward in our own evolution, because we know now, things have just changed in the past couple of decades with the Hubble and the Kepler telescopes. We know now there's at least 100 billion other galaxies out there, along with ours. And when a star, and they all have their own stars with their own planets, and when a star bursts, there's stardust that is spread throughout the universe. We're made of stardust. In fact, we know now that there are amino acids and hydrogen and nitrogen and oxygen and the building blocks of life that are out there. Our Milky Way galaxy is only 14 to 16 billion years old. Our solar system is a very young solar system. It's only 4 to 6 billion years old. Yep. So there are scientists now postulating that there could be sentient, intelligent beings out there billions of years ahead of us. They might even be here already. So, you know, I mean, we have 70% of our Earth is the ocean. Who knows what's going on down there? And many pilots have reported, as well as civilians, these UFOs, UAP, whatever, these UPs, actually coming out of the ocean and then shooting straight up into the air. So who knows what's going on underneath our seas? They may have been here for a lot longer than we have.
Absolutely. Well, Shag Harbour in Canada is a prime example of that situation, because that's one of probably the best reported, because they're known as USOs, aren't they?
Right.
That's probably the first case that comes to mind, because that's exactly what happened there, because it was actually seen, the lights were seen under the water maneuvering.
Right. But there are many other reports. And I just want to, because I know time is of the essence here, one other aspect that's really poignant and important is, and another little coincidence, is that 6 months before the mass sighting, because my background has been community education of vital health issues since 1976, when I first started presenting health reports on NBC in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and a syndication, international syndication, actually grew from that. And then in 1980, when we moved to Phoenix, it was already showing here. And I also did a health program for NBC here, and then USA Cable, and started my own company in 85 to wake kids up to the reality of substance abuse. And my substance abuse and AIDS and teen pregnancy prevention education programs are currently and have been for decades distributed by Discovery Education. When this fell in my lap, I also felt an obligation to not only learn about it, but also share the data. And ultimately, after 7 years and a 750-page journal later, I condense the best of what I found, and it's continued to evolve, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program. So now it's in its third print, the latest edition, and has the video as well, the documentary, which has won over a dozen International Film Festival awards. We're so proud, and we keep adding to the bonus features. And I just completed a graphic novel activities coloring book, getting back to my passion for youth, that is called The Phoenix Lights, UFOs and Crop Circles. There's 80 crop circles coloring book, Adventure Sue FO Field Observer, and Hugh, H-U-G-H, Hugh FO. And I work with a Disney illustrator and pilot programs and the classroom and a map maker, and we show the 10 different craft to scale. I mean, it's an 80 crop circles and activities, word finders and crossword puzzles. It's really, really fun. 150 pages for the black and white version, 160 pages for the color version. They're all available at Amazon and in Amazon UK as well, for anybody that wants to look for the Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Alone, and the Phoenix Lights Beyond Top Secret, and the graphic novel. I you know, welcome anybody to look. The data is there now if you care to look at it. It's really fascinating, and the graphic novel is fun for all ages. I have teachers using it. I have grandparents and parents doing it with their kids, and people just coloring it on their own. They love it. But anyway, 6 months before the mass sighting, I was invited to present my substance abuse program, prevention education program, at the Gila Bend Indian Reservation, which, if you look at the pictures on the photo page, you can see the topography. South Mountain is on the left side, and then a few miles back is the Estrella Mountain Range. And in the basin in between are the Gila Bend Indian Reservation sacred grounds. And 6 months before, they invited me to their one school to present my substance abuse program because they had some problems, and I got friendly with the teachers and the principal, and they don't talk to outsiders. But after the mass sighting 6 months later, I noticed that in my pictures, and again, the data speaks for itself, these phenomena keep popping up right where South Mountain and the Estrellas intersect. So I called them up and I spoke to the principal and I said, do you know if there's anyone who saw strange lights on March 13th? And he started to giggle. And I said, is that funny? And he said, are you kidding? We've been looking up at them for centuries. We call them sky people. Like, it's yeah. Part of their, I had no idea. That was the first I had heard of it, which really opened up a whole world to me of the fact that Native cultures worldwide are much more open to these phenomena as being otherworldly. And in fact, the Hopi right here in Arizona have protocols to invite them in. Mm-hmm. The Navajo Range has rangers, law enforcement, that I'm working with now for the last few years, and MUFON is as well, that are studying these phenomena, and they had a big sighting the day before ours. They're so used to it and welcome these things that they just put out their lawn chairs and they're watching the words going around in circles for over an hour. And so it's amazing that Native cultures are so much more open to these things as being otherworldly and being other intelligences. In fact, some of them believe that these orbs are spirit world, their ancestors coming to give them comfort and knowledge and inspiration. And I have to admit, Paul, I, you know, would have never, ever chosen this topic, but I certainly have been inspired to do what I did, give up my whole medical career to do this. But it's that important as a scientist, as a physician, to let people know they're not crazy, even though most anomalies can be explained. Just because we don't have the technology yet to definitively define what these things are, it doesn't mean they're not real. Mm-hmm. And when somebody has a paranormal experience, it's real to them. We talk about that in the documentary, that it's important to share, at least with one person. And I urge people, look on Facebook, Phoenix Lights Network, Facebook page, the website, contact me. Even if I'm not one person, I love to hear from people. And it's very cathartic and healing to share. And as an experiencer, and then certainly as an educator, I had to do this. I couldn't just stick it in a drawer, which, by the way, Paul, I really considered really seriously to just stick everything in the drawer, show it to my grandchildren years from now. And they're very into it, by the way. And they just had a sighting here a couple weeks ago with me, which was very interesting. And, you know, and just ask them what they think. Children are very open to this. They thirst for this knowledge. So actually, July 28th, I'm going to be hosting a youth program all afternoon at the MUFON International Symposium, their 50th anniversary in Orange County, California. And anybody that's in the States or that's nearby there or coming into the States at that time, it's going to be one of a kind. It's the first time that anybody's doing this. We're using the graphic novel. I'm showing the documentary. And every year we have, I host a anniversary showing of the documentary, and we have speakers afterwards. And there's always, always a dozen or more kids in the audience that have read the book, that, you know, have seen the documentary, and that are really, I mean, children are really, really into this topic. Yeah. And, you know, they're much more open to this than a lot of adults are. So,
absolutely. I mean, that's what's always struck me about everything I've seen you involved in since I saw the documentary. I've always been struck by your tenacity and your genuine thirst to find out what's gone on here, and you know, and all credit to you, because, you know, as you refer to, you were a very successful physician. You had an established career, and I've said this to a couple of other guests that I've interviewed in regards to different subjects, Dr. Lynn. Mm-hmm. But I'm always of I admire people like yourself for having the bravery to put your head above the parapet and say, I know what I saw, I want to understand what I saw, and you can't tell me any different. And I think, you know, all credit to yourself, because you've probably helped hundreds of people come to terms with what happened to them that day.
I hope to say thousands of people, because I have to say, I would have never come forward, number one, if I didn't, you know, have the 35 millimeter that to this day, university and military analysts have tried to give me an answer to what they are, and they can't. Mm. They're true unknowns. And secondly, there's so many people, as a physician, certainly, I know that there's millions of people out there that need to have a voice. If I can just be a credible voice, so that people actually look at the data, then I've done my job. It's not about me. It's about the data. So I hope your listeners will actually look at the data, then I've done my job. So I appreciate you saying that. And we need more credible people coming forward. That's what it's all about now. And it's important. I think that they, now that it's being, especially in the States, more openly addressed, and it's celebrities. In fact, Alice Cooper, the music icon, just came forward this year publicly. He had told me years ago that he had seen the Phoenix Lights, but he came forward publicly this year to share it at our event, which is always sold out for the 14th year at the Scottsdale Park and Shea Theater. So the more people, credible people, and I hope there's some credible people listening out there that will come forward and say, you know what, I know what I saw, and again, most anomalies can be explained, but the fact that not only do I have the 35 millimeter data, but thousands of people. If thousands of people hadn't seen what I've been seeing, I have to tell you, Paul, I could not have come forward. I would have just been, you know, plastered to the wall, just like the other people were. You can't fight with thousands of people.
No, very true.
They saw the same thing at the same time.
So strength in numbers.
There you go. With Murray, it's amazing how the puzzle pieces keep fitting together, and it's almost like it's orchestrated. You know, I mean, I hate to, I don't want to feed into any conspiracy things, but there's also coincidences. We talk about that in the bonus features on March 13th that are really, you know, talk about coincidences. There was a satellite that went dead that night that is supposed to detect incoming missiles, and it was built in Chandler, Arizona. So they told Village Labs directly that it went dead that night. Number one. Number two, and it didn't mention the Phoenix Lights, but a few months later in Scientific America, there in July of 1997, there was a number of pages that were dedicated to the fact that there were strange gamma rays that came into our atmosphere on March 13th, 1997. Also, the fact that then President Bill Clinton was rushed out from Greg Norman, the golfer in Florida's home during the mass sighting to an undisclosed location, and they publicize it as that he broke his knee, but there's no photographs of that. And fourth, and this is just speculation, but I was told by some very reliable sources that we went to DEFCON 3 that night. So, you know, and again, we know that the military knew what was going on. So, you know, there were coincidences just on that day alone. So there's so much more to the story. And I hope people will pick up the book and learn more about the Phoenix Lights, because there's a lot more to the story.
Absolutely. Well, I recommend the books and the document. The documentary is fantastic. And it's something I watch every year on the anniversary, Dr. Lynn, because I've always enjoyed it, and because it's a case I found absolutely compelling, even from this side of the Atlantic.
Yes, and it's interesting to hear it from the people themselves, isn't it, Paul?
Oh, it's fabulous, and because, you know, these are genuine people who have seen something that's changed their life, quite often for the better, because it's given them a wider understanding both of themselves and probably the world around them. So, for you now, going forwards, here we are, like we said at the beginning, it's 22 years on. Are you still surprised to get new witnesses coming forwards, or is it something that you think that perhaps there are still some tantalizing stories out there you've yet to hear?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the story keeps on evolving. New people keep coming forward, which is wonderful, and I really urge people to come forward, and even if it's just to share it with me, that's okay. It really is healing and cathartic for those who have had a paranormal experience. But the more celebrities, the more people of note and military and pilots, which they're starting to now, you know, come forward, because I think the whole shading and cloud is really starting to dissipate, and the sun is starting to shine through. The light is starting to shine through the reality that we are not alone in the universe. And it just makes sense. I mean, as I mentioned, I mean, there could be beings out there that are billions of years ahead of us, not just out there. But in the book, I also get into the analysis of the 1995 pictures by Navy optical physicist Dr. Bruce McAbee, who took the first and the last picture, and we thought it was only a few minutes, actually did a meticulous study to show that there were groups of lights in the skyline that were on in the first picture that were out in this last picture, groups of lights. It doesn't happen in a couple minutes. And he had me do an experiment and presented the case in 1999 to the MUFON International Symposium in Washington, D.C., as the first and, as far as we know, the only authenticated photographic evidence of missing time. So we have, you know, other times and spaces, along with our concept of time is very primitive. It's linear. It might be a spiral. We don't know what else is out there. And if there's other times and spaces along with ours, you know, who's to say how many intelligent beings are in those other times and spaces that we get glimpses of if we're open to them or invited. So, you know, there is so much to the story and so much to think about and to consider. And if you're open to it. And that's the other thing. Some people can't deal with this topic and some people don't want to, and that's okay. And if you want to get into the flare theory, that's okay. But as you said, I mean, more and more people are starting to become open to this and to realize and seeing things. That's the other thing. Yeah. I mean, now that we have social media, it can be shown in a heartbeat. And even though most can be explained, there are things out there that we're documenting on film that cannot be explained. So it's time we stop it's foolishness to think that there isn't something going on and to really address it and accept it and
absolutely
study.
Yeah, I think I was speaking to one of my other guests recently, Dr. Irina Scott, and I was saying at the moment, in the last couple of years, there seems to be a real momentum for a more honest scientific approach to this subject. It seems like something has really changed somewhere, because obviously, you know, like you referred to the New York Times article by Leslie Keene, and then obviously we've had the footage released from the Navy pilots, and then obviously we've got the US Navy have changed their reporting structures because of internal issues with the guys saying basically we're sick to death of this being made to feel stupid about these things. What do you think's pushed that towards a more honest kind of look at this subject matter?
Well, just what you just mentioned. I mean, the fact that these have been going on for centuries and that other countries are much more open to these as being otherworldly. And as you know, Nick Pope was in the Ministry of Defense there, and he's now speaking very freely about the fact that, this is real. Something's really out there. And I think we've been actually, if you look back and again, look at the data since Roswell, we have been spoon-fed. Initially, they thought it would cause panic, so they tried to cover up as much as they could. But slowly but surely, it's been seeping out there. And J. Allen Hynek, who was plucked out of Northwestern, he was the head of astronomy there, to be the head of Project Blue Book, which was the only official public study. There were others going on behind the scenes, Project Grudge and Sign and so forth. Yep. But he was told, quite frankly, and there's a show now, Project Blue Book on the History Channel, that even though it's very dramatic, will show how he was coerced to actually debunk most all sightings and the real ones to push under the carpet. And he actually, and I'll leave you with this, because he made a statement that was really poignant. He said, science happens in threes. The first stage is complete disbelief. Yep. Second stage is, well, it might be so. And the third and final stage is, I knew it all the time. So we're getting closer and closer to that final stage, don't you?
Absolutely, and I hope so as well. I mean, obviously, before I let you go, we have to sort of touch on the very sad news this week that we've lost one of the titans of ufology, Stanton Friedman, on Monday. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was someone, you know, I've seen not a great deal, but I've certainly seen his opinion on the Phoenix Lights, and he was always extremely positive about the evidence. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get the chance to sort of discuss the case with him at all?
Oh, yes. We spoke at a number of conferences. In fact, we were supposed to speak on a couple coming up, but sadly, he is gone. But his work will definitely live on. And if you are on Facebook out there, I posted some pictures of us together on the Phoenix Lights Network page and my own page, because it is a sad day. It is a sad day to lose someone who is so prominent, so credible and professional and kind, that, you know, we've lost quite a few in the past few years. We lost Jim Mars just a few years ago, and others that have really been icons in the field. But luckily, his work is out there and his name is out there, and people hopefully will take a look at his work. And he was a physicist. I mean, he was a scientist. And like myself, really looked into these phenomena in a very scientific way. And for that, he was like, you know, almost like a mentor to me in how to proceed with this. So, you know, the pictures are terrific pictures, and I hope people will look at those pages and see what a kind face he has and a kind smile. And you know, he will be missed for sure.
Absolutely. So, what's next for you? And where can anybody keep up to date with all your work and forthcoming events and things that you've got planned?
Well, again, Paul, I so appreciate you letting me share the inside Phoenix Light story, but there's a lot more to it, and I hope people will check out the Phoenix Lights Network website. It is just packed, as you know, with really intriguing information. The photo page, the cap page, the home page has a lot on there. The upcoming events on the events page, the share page, as well as the Phoenix Lights Network Facebook page. And then we have the book, The Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Alone, in its third print. And I actually recommend the digital copy the Kindle copy. It can be played on any digital player because there's colored pictures and live links that I also added so that people can explore further if they choose. We have the Phoenix Lights Beyond Top Secret documentary, and if you have Amazon Prime, you can watch it for free. And we also have the graphic novel activities coloring book for all ages. And coming up, I'll be speaking on Friday. Let's see, the date is actually May 31st at 10:30 in the morning at Contact in the Desert, Indian Wells, and then my workshop that will really get into the personal witness testimony and how it really touched people at such a deep level, and also how people can communicate with these other phenomena, which I've been doing for many, many years since my near-death experience at 8 years old. And we'll talk about that. Also, I have coming up in July, I have on the 28th, the MUFON International Symposium Youth Program from 1 to 5. And they can look that up on the MUFON International website. And then for people that might be interested in a cruise, I am planning on going on being a speaker on a UFO cruise, which is really going to be phenomenal, with some of the iconic speakers, Linda Moulton Howe and Richard Dolan and a whole host of others, October the 6th to the 12th. And I have all those listed on the Phoenix Lights Network page, as on the events page, as well as on the Phoenix Lights Network Facebook page. So I hope some of your listeners will join us. It should be really, really fun. And there's a lot more coming up, which hopefully we'll talk again and we'll be able to share.
Oh, I'd look forward to it. It's been an absolute pleasure. You're someone I've wanted to speak to for a very, very long time. I'm a big fan of your work, and you've got nothing but my gratitude for what you've done in regards to this case. So thank you again for your time today.
And so appreciate being here. I really do, Paul, and having your listeners hear some of the data. And I just want to tell them and you to keep looking up.
Always. Always. Well, thank you. You take care and the very best of luck. And let's hope Contact in the Desert's a good celebration for Stanton as well. So take care.